This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, friends.
Good morning.
What a lovely day to sit together. As I was preparing for this talk, I asked myself, how did I get here? To be giving this talk to this Sangha or community here at Jikoji. To answer this question for myself, I thought back to what led me to this Soto Zen practice, my journey or way-seeking mind. I often wonder about how other speakers or practitioners get to their practice. And I want to share my story and talk about a few other things. In the 1990s, I came across a small book called The Way to Love, The Last Meditations of Anthony DeMello. I'd like to read just two of the 31 meditations from this book. Nowhere to go. Foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Matthew 8:20. Here is a mistake that most people make in their relationships with others. They try to build a steady nesting place in the ever-moving stream of life. Think of someone whose love you desire. Do you want to be important to this person, to be special and make a difference to his or her life? Do you want this person to care for you and be concerned about you in a special way? If you do, open your eyes and see that you are foolishly inviting others to reserve you for themselves, to restrict your freedom for their benefit, to control your behavior, your growth and development so that it will suit their interest. It is as if the other person said to you, if you want to be a special to me, then you must meet my conditions. Because the moment you cease to live up to my expectations, you will cease to be a special. You wanted to be a special to someone, didn't you? So you must pay a price in lost freedom. You must dance to the other person's tune, just as you demand that other persons dance to yours if they want to be special to you. Pause now to ask yourself if it is worth paying so much for so little. Imagine you say to this person whose special love you want, leave me free to be myself, to think my thoughts, to indulge my taste, to follow my inclinations, to behave in ways that I decide are to my liking. The moment you say those words, you will understand that you are asking for the impossible. To ask to be special to someone means, essentially, to be bound to the task of making yourself pleasing to this person, and therefore to lose your freedom. Take all the time you need to realize this. Maybe now you're ready to say, I'd rather have my freedom than your love. I'd rather, if you could either have company in prison or walk the earth in freedom all alone, which would you choose? Now say to this person, I leave you free to be yourself, to think your thoughts, to indulge your taste, follow your inclinations, behave in any way that you decide is to your liking. Either your heart will resist these words, and you will be exposed for the clinger and exploiter that you are. So now is the time to examine your false belief that without this person you cannot live or cannot be happy. Or your heart will pronounce those words sincerely, and in that very instant, all control, manipulation, exploitation, possessiveness, jealousy will drop. I leave you free to be yourself, to think your thoughts, indulge your taste, follow your inclinations, behave in ways that you decide are to your liking. And you will notice something else. The person automatically ceases to be special and important to you. And he or she becomes important the way a sunset or a symphony is lovely in itself. The way a tree is special in itself, and not for the fruit or the shade that it can offer you. Your beloved will then belong not to you, but to everyone, or to no one, like the sunrise and the tree. Test it by saying those words again. I leave you free to be yourself. In saying those words, you have set yourself free. You are now ready to love. For when you cling, what you offer the other is not love, but a chain by which both you and your beloved are bound. Love can only exist in freedom. The true lover seeks the good of his beloved, which requires especially the liberation of the beloved from the lover. Second meditation. No stone will be left. When his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple, he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Matthew 24:1-2. Think of a flabby person covered with layers of fat. This is what your mind can become: flabby, covered with layers of fat, till it becomes too dull and lazy to think, to observe, to explore, to discover. It loses its alertness, its aliveness, its flexibility, and goes to sleep. Look around you and you will see almost everyone with minds like that, dull, asleep, protected by layers of fat, not wanting to be disturbed or questioned into wakefulness. What are these layers? Every belief that you hold, every conclusion you have reached about persons and things, every habit and every attachment. In your formative years, you should have been helped to scrape off those layers and liberate your mind. Instead, your society, your culture, which put these layers on your mind in the first place, has educated you to not even notice them, to go to sleep and let other people, the experts, your politicians, your cultural and religious leaders, do the thinking for you. So you are weighed down with the load of unexamined, unquestioned authority and tradition. Let us examine these layers one at a time. First, your beliefs. If you experience life as a communist or a capitalist, as a Muslim or a Jew, you're experiencing life in a prejudiced, slanted way. There is a barrier, a layer of fat between capital R reality and you, because you no longer see and touch it directly. Second layer, your ideas. If you hold on to an idea about someone, then you no longer love that person, but your idea of that person. You see him or her do or say something or behave in a certain kind of way, and you slap a label on. She is silly, or he is dull, or he is cruel, or she is very sweet, etc. So now you have a screen, a layer of fat between you and this person, because when you next meet him or her, you will experience them in terms of that idea of yours, even though they have changed. Observe how you have done this with almost everyone you know. Third layer, habits. A habit is essential to human living. How would we ever walk or speak or drive a car unless we relied on habit? But habits must be limited to things mechanical, not to love or to sight. Who wants to be loved from habit? Have you ever sat on a seashore spellbound by the majesty and the mystery of the ocean? A fisherman looks at the ocean daily and does not notice its grandeur. Why? The dulling effect of a layer of fat called habit. You have formed fixed ideas of all the things you see, and when encountering them, it is not them you see in all their changing freshness, but the same dull, thick, boring idea acquired through habit. And that is how you deal with people and with things, how you relate to them. No freshness, no newness, but the same dull, boring routine always produced by habit. You are incapable of looking in other creative ways for having developed a habit for dealing with the world and with people, you can put your mind on automatic pilot and go to sleep. Fourth layer, your attachments and your fears. This layer is the easiest to see. Put a thick coating of attachment, of fear, and therefore dislike, onto anything or anyone. In that very instant, you cease to see that person or thing as it really is. Just recall some of the persons you dislike or fear or are attached to, and you will see how true this is. Do you see now how you are in a prison created by the beliefs and traditions of your society and culture, and by the ideas, prejudices, attachments, and fears of your past experiences? Wall upon wall surrounds your prison cells so that it seems almost impossible that you will ever break out and make contact with the richness of life and love and freedom that lies beyond your prison fortress. And yet the task, far from being impossible, is actually easy and delightful. What can you do to break out? Four things. First, realize that you are surrounded by prison walls, that your mind has gone to sleep. It does not even occur to most people to see this. So they live and die as prison inmates. Most people end up being conformists. They adapt to prison life. A few become reformers. They fight for better living conditions in the prison, better lighting, better ventilation. Hardly anyone becomes a rebel, a revolutionary who breaks down the prison walls. You can only be a revolutionary when you see the prison walls in the first place. Second, contemplate the walls. Spend hours just observing your ideas, your habits, your attachments, and your fears without any judgment or condemnation. Look at them and they will crumble. Third, spend some time observing the things and people around you. Look, but really look at it for the first time, at the face of a friend, a leaf, a tree, a bird in flight, the behavior and mannerisms of the people around you. Really see them, and hopefully you will see them afresh as they are in themselves without the dulling, stupefying effect of your ideas and habits. The fourth and most important step, sit down quietly and observe how your mind functions. There is a steady flow of thoughts and feelings and reactions there. Watch the whole of it for long stretches of time, the way you watch a river or a movie. You will soon find it so much more absorbing than any river or movie, and so much more life-giving and liberating. Can you even be said to be alive if you are not even conscious of your own thoughts and reactions? The unaware life, it is said, is not worth living. It cannot even be called life. It is a mechanical robot existence, a sleep, an unconsciousness, a death. And yet this is what people call human life. So watch, observe, question, explore, and your mind will come alive and shed its fat and become keen and alert and active. Your prison walls will come tumbling down till not one stone of the temple will be left upon another. And you will be blessed with the unimpeded vision of things as they are, the direct experience of reality. These are not the writings of a Zen master, but of a Jesuit priest and psychotherapist from India. I had not read anything like it before. These were new ideas to me, a new way in which to experience the world, nature, people, my thinking, my mind. Through the years, I would pick up this book and reread the gems that challenged me, greatly influenced me, and opened my heart and my awareness to, as Suzuki Roshi would say, things as it is. This profound little book prepared me for my eventual Zen practice. Years passed. About 8 years ago, when I experienced overwhelming anxiety and stress due to my work, I realized that I just needed to sit down and be quiet. I needed peace in my mind and my body. I started to meditate about 5 minutes a day. I bought some books about meditation. One of the books mentioned finding a teacher and a sangha or community of other people to sit with. After a year of meditating on my own, I thought it was time for me to look for a place to practice with others. Some of the meditation books mentioned Zen Buddhism. So I started looking online for a place to sit with others. After closely reviewing a few websites of Zen places nearby, I was drawn to the online description of Floating Zendo in San Jose because of the quote from Angie Boisevain, from the book called Seeds of Virtue, Seeds of Change. Zazen practice brings us back to our onlyness, our aloneness, our oneness. It helps us face the lies and the sometimes difficult truth of how our life is going. Even when we discover mistakes and lies we've been hiding from ourselves, in the end, there's a tremendous freshness and a great relief to be honest. Our only activity is to return to the present, to be this right now place. So one rainy Tuesday evening in mid-January, 7 years ago, I nervously went to the floating Zendo. After that one visit, I knew this was what I needed. Zazen. I didn't quite understand it, but somehow I felt at home. There, I found my teacher, Angie Boisevain, now retired, and a Sangha, both in floating Zendo and this place, Jikoji. My current teacher is Paula Jones, one of Jikoji's guiding teachers. I will mention here that Angie and Paula were students of Koban, the founder of this rustic, peaceful place where we find ourselves today. That is my way-seeking mind story. There's a lot written and spoken about our practice of just sitting, or shikantaza. It is a body-mind practice, sitting upright and concentrating on the breath. The mind will be what it is as you sit. It may be calm or all over the place and everything in between. You may play reruns of things that happened in the past, conversations you've had or want to have, hear birds sing, hear the person breathing next to you. Think about what you'll have for dinner. I like the visualization that thoughts are like clouds. They come and they go. Some clouds are big, dark, and looming. Other clouds are soft and wispy and disappear quickly. Let your thoughts go like clouds and go back to the breath. So you may wonder, is there anything to gain from sitting? We learn that in order to truly sit Zazen, you sit with no goal in mind. I'll say that again. We learn that in order to truly sit Zazen, you sit with no goal in mind. Like we chanted in the Heart Sutra, with nothing to attain. Don't think it will make you a better person or bring you peace. Just sit and be yourself facing the wall. Observe your breath. Sitting for a period of time every day is a good practice. After practicing Zazen for some time, you may feel different. Don't take my word for it. I can't sit for you and tell you what it feels like. You have to find out for yourself. I'd like to talk a bit about bringing our practice to the life we live, through the relationships we have with others, our family, friends, workmates, acquaintances, those with whom we are intimate with, and complete strangers. We learn in Zen that all phenomena are impermanent. Uchiyama Roshi writes, impermanence, shogyo mujo, means that every living thing dies. In other words, everything that has life loses life. Moreover, no one, least of all the living thing itself, knows exactly when its life will end. Life has a limit, and it is always in a state of uncertainty. This is the first undeniable reality. Impermanence also means that in every moment, everything changes. That includes each and every one of us. My mom is 94 years old. I've watched her change through the years from a vibrant, bright, fast-walking, energetic woman to one that is now frail and very much slowed down. However, she enjoys being with her family, gardening, cleaning the house, and watching her favorite sports teams, Golden State Warriors, San Jose Sharks, Oakland A's. I'm fully aware that her life may end at any time. I'm actually not sad about it because she's lived a good life. And it continues. It's not been easy for her, though. Mom was born and raised in the Philippines, one of 11 children. She put herself through college at the University of the Philippines as a music major in voice, minoring in piano. Ah, how angelic she is, and her operatic voice was. She raised four children, has four grandchildren, and one great-grandson. She started and ran our family business for 25 years and helped so many people along the way. Every time I visit her and Dad at their house, I don't know how she'll be, happy or down, in the present or nostalgic. In any case, she's always grateful. Regardless of how she presents at that time, I just roll with how she is. However she is. Besides love and time together, that's the greatest gift I can give to her. To meet her as she is, right here, right now. The present time is all we have. This brings me to how I approach every person. I continually work on dropping my ideas, my expectations, my attachments about the people I come in contact with. I meet them where they are. Which brings me to a conversation I had with my friend Ross a few weeks ago about how my attitude during driving has changed in the past few years. I used to get upset at people who cut me off, drove too slowly, or too fast. And you know, all the stuff that happens when we drive, traffic, etc. What I have found is the car is a great place to practice. To practice compassion for others and kindness. Giving people the benefit of the doubt. We don't know what their circumstance is, where their mind is or isn't. After having said all that I've said, it really doesn't matter to me if you got anything from this talk. What matters to me the most is that I leave you free to be yourself, to think your thoughts, indulge your taste, follow your inclinations, and behave in any way you decide is to your liking.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.